This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Thursday, system at breaking point. Nurses call for urgent help as staffing shortages worsen in aged care. And you'll hear from a doctor treating Omicron patients in ICU. Has the wave peaked?
Certainly from an intensive care point of view, it does seem to be that the numbers are gradually going down as we are discharging patients from intensive care. We're not getting that steady stream coming in like we were seeing before with Delta.
First up today, we're talking gas, and meetings between French, German, Russian and Ukrainian diplomats have failed to resolve escalating tension as troops mass on the border between Russia and Ukraine. The four countries did, however, agree on a ceasefire ahead of a second round of talks in 2 weeks. Australia is now considering how to supply liquefied natural gas to Europe if Russia cuts off supply, Dale Drinkwater reports.
Europe is in the depths of its winter, where temperatures hover between freezing and below freezing. Now, more than ever, people need their power supply to stay warm. But amid growing tensions between Ukraine and Russia, the US and UK fear that power supply could be at risk. Here's British leader Boris Johnson.
That's why we're working together with President Biden, with other colleagues, to see what we can do to increase the supply of gas, both to Europe and, of course, to this country as well.
Around 3% of the UK's gas comes from Russia, which Boris Johnson says puts them in a better position to resist what he calls
the Russian gas blackmail.
But Germany's in a tougher position. More than a third of its gas supply comes from Russia's pipelines. US officials say Russia has already restricted the flow of natural gas by half through Ukraine's pipelines to Europe. It comes amid fears from the international community that Russia will invade the Eastern European country. Michael Pulsch is the European Union's ambassador to Australia.
It is a threat not only to a country, a sovereign country like Ukraine, but also to the international community as such and to the established rules-based orders that we've given us.
A worried Germany has since been part of attempts to de-escalate tensions between Russia and Ukraine. But a meeting between Germany, Russia, Ukraine and France yesterday failed to reach any settlement around conflict in eastern Ukraine. It did land on a ceasefire, though, to hold out until the next meeting between the countries in another 2 weeks. Australian Resources Minister Keith Pitt has welcomed that news.
And once again, we would call on them to de-escalate tensions in the region. But clearly there's been an impact on gas prices around the world and on oil prices, I have to say. Oil's at about $90 a barrel. That's the highest it's been for about 8 years.
Australia, the United States and Qatar supply around half of the world's shipped liquid natural gas. Keith Pitt says if needed, Australia will step up without impacting current gas contracts.
Now, we don't have any formal requests, but you know, clearly we do stand ready to stand with our friends and allies when they have a shortfall, and of course we'll have to do that out of uncontracted gas.
The Grattan Institute's Energy Program Director, Tony Wood, says to a lesser extent that's already been happening.
Some Australian gas has already been used to help supplement the problem at the moment, but of course it could get worse if the situation in the Ukraine gets worse.
With high gas prices in Europe, it could be an opportunity for Australian gas suppliers to export into the market. But there's also no certainty around how it would work if it were to expand.
Now, of course, it doesn't mean that Australia actually supplies its gas to Europe. Australia's a long way from Europe. It could mean that gas that otherwise might go to Asia is diverted to Europe and then Australian gas replaces that gas in Asia.
Whether any of this will be necessary might be clearer after a meeting between France's Emmanuel Macron and Russia's Vladimir Putin tomorrow. But Tony Wood thinks Russia might think carefully about whether or not to cut gas.
It would not necessarily be in Russia's best interest to cut gas because they're a country that depends upon things like oil and gas for a huge amount of its import of its income. So it wouldn't do that.
That's the Grattan Institute's Tony Wood ending that report from Dale Drinkwater. Well, let's take a look at aged care now. And the Nurses Union says the lives of aged care residents are at risk due to continuously dangerous low levels of staffing. The Acting Federal Secretary of the Australian Nursing and Midwifery Federation, Lorianne Sharp, is renewing its calls to deploy the Australian Defence Force to provide emergency support.
We need ADF support as an immediate action. We need to have a surge workforce that starts immediately and assists the current workers on the ground, because I'm not sure how much longer they're going to be able to hold up.
National Cabinet is meeting today as hundreds of aged care facilities remain in lockdown. So what's it like for senior Australians who are caught up in the crisis? Rosemary Seam is an 82-year-old aged care resident on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. The facility she lives in has been hit hard by COVID staffing shortages. As a result, garden and maintenance staff have been delivering meals and doing laundry.
We've been in lockdown intermittently since March 2020. This last occasion, we've been in lockdown since just after Christmas, as we've had a COVID outbreak. We've been confined to our rooms. We'll all be glad to get out, put it that way.
Have you found it difficult, Rosemary?
The staff are doing their best to keep us from going quackers, I suppose you'd say. I could just say thank goodness for the internet. It's a wonderful way of keeping in touch with friends and family. I think the internet has really kept me sane. It's been my lifesaver.
How much do you feel for the residents who have dementia, who've also been in lockdown for this long period and not able to get out?
I think it's been very hard for them, from my observation. Hard for them because they haven't been able to get outside for their walks twice a day, and they don't understand why they're confined to their rooms, you know. I think it must be very hard for them. You can really sympathise with them, I think.
What's been happening with staff? Because some staff have been off on furlough. Have they been bringing in some of the outside staff to come in and work indoors to help out?
Staffing has been an issue. The maintenance staff have really risen to the occasion. They've been wonderful. One of the young gardeners has been delivering meals and helping, collecting rubbish. He's done a wonderful job. He sort of adapted really well, always a happy soul. And then the chief engineer, he's anywhere and everywhere. Like, all the laundry staff have been off and he's been filling in the laundry. He's acting as a barista, making coffee, and everybody's sort of pitching in and making an effort. It's really good.
What's it been like for you being separated from family, Rosemary?
Well, it's hard, but I'm probably one of the lucky ones because I can talk to them any time on the internet. I've got a son in Ireland. I've got grandchildren in Scotland, as well as locally and in Sydney. They're in touch every day, I would say, so it's really wonderful. All I can say is thank goodness for the internet. I think it's kept me sane.
What would you most like Australians to understand about what it's like being in aged care at the moment in the middle of this pandemic?
I'd probably say to them, don't forget we're here. We're still here. We're still standing. But we're really looking forward to the day when everything goes back to normal and we can open up, we can start going out again, and we're just looking forward to everything getting back to normal. But we understand why all these restrictions are in place. It's for our own benefit. I think the staff have done the best they can under the circumstances. They've been very stretched at times, I think. They've been working double shifts and some of them are just so tired, I think. I think they've been wonderful. I really think the staff in aged care facilities are the unsung heroes of this pandemic. I really do.
How much do you feel for the staff who are trying to work their way through this at the moment?
I have felt a lot for them. I think probably now we're starting to come out the other side of the worst of it, but I really have felt for the staff, and I definitely think they're all worth more money. If it was in my power to pay them more, I would. And I just think you have to be a special kind of person to work in aged care. It is a caring profession.
So important to hear from those who are in aged care. That's aged care resident Rosemary Seam there. Well, Australians are about to get their first taste of take-at-home treatments for COVID. The TGA has provisionally approved the use of two oral antivirals, which it's hoped will prevent higher-risk patients from being hospitalised. The drugs have been in use for several weeks in the USA, where they've been hailed as a potential pandemic game changer. But there are caveats. North America correspondent Barbara Miller reports.
COVID took a hold of Jeff Carlson pretty quickly.
My lungs were feeling as though they were burning from the inside out. I had a very difficult time even starting to move, even to speak.
Within a day or two of developing symptoms, things weren't looking good.
It was terrible, absolutely terrible. The worst I've been in that I can recall in my life.
He could have been sent straight to hospital, but then the 61-year-old from Minnesota was offered take-at-home COVID pills, becoming one of the very first Americans to be prescribed the newly authorized drugs.
A drug that I would call a miracle drug. There's really no other way to say it. In my particular case, it turned my physical life around in a period of basically a day.
Australians will soon have access to COVID pills. The federal government has ordered 500,000 courses of the Pfizer drug Paxlovid and 300,000 of a Merck Molnupiravir drug. The pills are intended for COVID patients who are not hospitalised but are considered at risk of being admitted. In trials, Paxlovid had a much higher success rate in preventing hospitalisations compared with Molnupiravir. But Paxlovid has potentially dangerous interactions with other drugs. Dr. Catherine Yang is a clinical professor of pharmacy at UCSF.
It's a little bit of a catch-22 because in some cases, the toxicity associated with the drug interaction is extreme. Like you could get a cardiac arrhythmia. That's not worth the risk, right?
There are other catches with the new COVID pills. They have to be taken within 5 days of a person contracting COVID. That means a patient has to test, get the result, consult with doctors, and be prescribed the drugs in a very short space of time. The quicker the better. Dr. Brian Jerebik from M Health Fairview is working on the rollout of the drugs in Minnesota.
We've definitely had trouble here in Minnesota where we have such a surge right now of the Omicron variant that it's overwhelming some of our testing locations. So we've had to add some more testing locations and lanes and times with extended hours to be able to get more people through.
Finally, the drugs take a while to manufacture, so supplies currently are extremely limited. The arrival of the first at-home treatments is nevertheless a significant milestone in the pandemic.
This is really a game changer for COVID.
Jeff Carlson knows he's one of the lucky ones.
I believe it saved my life, and if it didn't save my life, it saved me from taking up another bed in the hospital.
First deliveries in Australia of the COVID pills are expected within weeks.
That's North America correspondent Barbara Miller. On ABC Radio, right across the country, you're listening to The World Today. We're back home now, and have we hit the peak of the Omicron wave? Well, Dr. Priya Nair is the Director of Intensive Care at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney. She says patients of various ages are ending up in ICU. Most are unvaccinated.
It's horrible to see somebody suffering from something we know could have been prevented or at least ameliorated. So it's hard for the staff and for us to watch that happening. And also the fact that their family is often unvaccinated as well. And even when they're very unwell and sometimes very critical, the family can't come in to see them for that reason. So it makes things a lot more complicated.
What do you say to the families?
Look, at that point when their family member is so unwell and they're so grief-stricken, it's really hard to say anything about vaccination. We try when we get an opportunity to talk to them about, you know, the benefits and how it really prevents serious illness, but it's not always possible when it comes to that point, you know, when they're that unwell.
Are some people still not believing that it is COVID even at that late stage?
Yes, there are still those non-believers, and it's just impossible, I think, in that group of patients to convince them otherwise because they've made their minds up and they've had ample opportunity. But if they still feel that way, it's really hard, I think, in some cases to change people's minds.
How do you deal with that?
Look, I think we don't really focus on that side of things when they're in intensive care. Focus is elsewhere, of course, because we're constantly providing interventions to try and get them better, keep them alive, communicate with the family, all of these things. Although that's an important issue, it really sort of fades to the background sometimes because our focus is elsewhere.
What's your sense of whether we've hit the peak as yet from your position in ICU?
Look, it's hard to say in a broader sense, of course, because I don't have access to that information. But certainly from an intensive care point of view, it does seem to be that the numbers are gradually going down as we are discharging patients from intensive care. We're not getting that steady stream coming in like we were seeing before with Delta. And I really hope that means we've hit the peak and we're coming down. We will see a long tail, I think, because, for example, in our intensive care at the moment, we've got at least 4 patients who will be in there for several weeks. So even when the numbers drop, I think our COVID ICUs will remain open for several weeks, caring for those patients in that long tail.
Are people with Omicron staying for a longer or a shorter period of time in ICU compared to the Delta wave?
Look, the feeling is that the length of stay is shorter. The problem is, of course, when they're in intensive care, we don't know whether they're Omicron or Delta because those results don't come to us in real time. They go centrally and then get reported overall. So we don't know that a particular patient has one strain or the other. But we do get the feeling that the ones that are presenting now with maybe slightly less severe illness, which may be the Omicrons, are staying for a shorter period of time.
How are things going for your team and their level of fatigue at the moment?
Yeah, that was the challenge actually for the Omicron spike, Sally, because this time we had a lot of staff members who tested positive. So at least a third or more of our staff in the last few weeks have tested positive at one time or another. The good part is none of them have been really sick, but of course it means that they can't come to work. And that is a significant impact on the other staff members looking after patients. So we've been very short staffed, not only here at St. Vincent's, but all across Sydney and Melbourne, I think, with staff testing positive. So that's been a new thing in the absence of lockdown with people testing positive. So I think that has been the major impact and therefore fatigue on the ones who remain working.
That's Dr. Priya Nair, Director of Intensive Care at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney. Well, tourism operators are calling on the federal government to urgently open the borders to international visitors as the tourism sector continues to struggle. Currently, only Australian residents and some visa holders are allowed in, including students and foreign workers, along with travellers from Japan and South Korea. But tourism leaders say it's not enough. Rhett Burney reports.
Our tourism sector has been one of the hardest hit industries during the pandemic. Even with more Australians travelling within their own country, the lack of overseas visitors has sent many tourism businesses to the brink. Mark Gleeson, who runs Australian Food Tours in South Australia, is experiencing just that.
We have an incredible billion-dollar industry in Australia that is going to the wolves because we don't have the people. We don't have the visitors. We're losing the infrastructure. We're losing our momentum.
Mark Gleeson's company works with international travel wholesalers to book food tours throughout Australia. But with the uncertainty around when the nation will throw open the borders to all international tourists, those contracts are getting cancelled, and he's not alone.
Tourism operators are turning to other jobs, you know, driving tractors, driving Ubers, opening other businesses, getting out of tourism.
Chuck McCoy owns Chuck's Little Wine Tours in McLaren Vale in South Australia. Overseas tourists made up a third of his business, and up until the pandemic, he operated 5 tour vans. He's down to 3 now.
In fact, our biggest client is a Sonoma-based wine company, and they haven't come back on at all. Whilst we're doing a little bit of work for them domestically, their international, and in fact their owners, haven't been able to come out and run their business.
The Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry says plans need to be put in place now to allow businesses time to prepare for the return of international tourists. Chief Executive Andrew McKellar.
We have to look forward and we have to say, well, what are the criteria for removing those border restrictions? How are we going to do that? What are the other things that the industry will need to get itself back on its feet?
Andrew McKellar acknowledges that's easier said than done, given the Omicron wave. But he says if the government doesn't reopen the borders to all foreign guests soon, it will need to pay to keep tourism businesses on life support.
If we're going to keep those businesses shuttered, then what sort of support will we need to have in order to ensure that the industry can be there when the doors are open?
Pressure's also mounting on Australia to follow the lead of countries like the UK, France and Switzerland, where fully vaccinated foreigners can enter without testing or quarantine arrival requirements. The International Air Transport Association released a statement urging governments across the globe to accelerate relaxation of travel restrictions and to remove all travel barriers, including quarantine and testing for those fully vaccinated with a WHO-approved vaccine. It says travellers should still provide a negative rapid antigen test, though. We asked Qantas and Virgin where it stands on the matter. Qantas didn't respond, but a spokesperson from Virgin said,
"We will continue to work with governments to assist in the recovery of the tourism and aviation industries. We're looking forward to safely welcoming all guests back to the skies."
And tourism operators like Chuck McCoy hope that happens sooner rather than later.
Run Australia like a business and let's get this business cranking. It's taken me 11 years to do what we do, and we've won lots of awards, but right now those awards aren't worth anything to us because we don't have anyone to showcase.
That's Chuck McCoy there from Chuck's Little Wine Tours in McLaren Vale in South Australia. Rhett Burney reporting. Well, finally today, welfare groups say some Australians have stopped using their cars as the cost of filling up at the pump soars to record highs. The NRMA says the price of regular unleaded fuel is now averaging above 170 cents a litre and proving too costly for many on low incomes. The fuel hikes come as rents also rise at the fastest annual pace since 2007. Our business reporter David Taylor looks at how the rising cost of living is pushing some Australians into financial distress.
If you drive a car, you'll have no doubt felt the financial pain at the pump. Motoring Group NRMA spokesperson Peter Currie says petrol prices continue to flirt with record highs.
We broke the record in December last year, and in Sydney at least, and in the other capital cities at various stages of November and December, and other capital cities at some point are likely to get there soon.
Peter Currie describes a perfect storm, including the threat of war in Eastern Europe, for pushing the cost of filling up higher.
So as the global economy continues to open up now out of its various stages of COVID lockdown, there just isn't enough supply meeting the growing demand for oil, and that's intentionally being done to put upward pressure on oil prices.
He says there will be little relief for motorists for the foreseeable future. It's troubling welfare groups like the Australian Council of Social Service. CEO Cassandra Goldie says many Australians on low incomes simply can't afford the tens of extra dollars now needed to fill up the car.
Well, we're hearing daily from people who just can't afford the petrol. They may have a car, but they can't afford to run it, or they're certainly deciding they can't keep a car because they cannot afford to use it. On top of energy bills, the increasing vegetables and other essentials of life, if you're in social security, it's just $45 a day on JobSeeker. There is no way that you can cope with this kind of petrol increase.
Alongside the cost of running a car, the cost of keeping a roof over your head is also proving incredibly stressful. According to property website Domain, Greater Sydney house prices skyrocketed by 33% last year, climbing 6% in the December quarter alone to a median price of $1.6 million. It's the steepest increase since records began in 1993. Unit price growth was more subdued, but still rose at an annual pace of 8.3%. Property research firm CoreLogic's head of research, Tim Lawless, says prices are still peaking.
Well, we've definitely reached the summit in the rate of growth, but we haven't quite reached the summit in terms of the peak in housing values.
Rents across the board have also risen at their fastest annual pace since 2007.
Absolutely. We've seen national house rents over the past 12 months are up by about 10.1%. Unit rents are up about 7.5% over the past year. Similar to housing values, we are seeing a bit of a slowdown in the rate of rental growth, But potentially, as we see international borders opening up and more migrants coming into Australia, chances are we could see rental demand once again bouncing back, especially across those inner city apartment markets where foreign visitors and students tend to focus most of their rental demand.
ACOS's Cassandra Goldie says the hard truth is that it's getting to the point where many on low incomes can't afford a car or a roof over their head.
Well, the reality is people are now unable to afford to rent. Their social security has been cut right back to just $45 a day. There are no protections at the moment from being evicted because you can't afford to pay for the rent. And of course, we're still in a very serious stage of the pandemic. So our housing crisis is chronic and rental prices are a big part of the problem.
There is some hope though. Westpac senior economist Matthew Hassan says he expects property price growth to moderate and even fall by the end of the year as interest rates rise.
That's David Taylor reporting. That's all from the World Today team. I'm Sally Sarah. Stay safe.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.